Chapter 20. Escape. Mary lost track of time after she began work on the panel. Ironically, the only tool she possessed that could sufficiently pry open the panel was still the damaged hair clip. Mary retrieved the clip from where it had fallen and resumed her efforts to open the panel since she had little choice in the matter. Initially, she was concerned her tampering with the device would incite the wrath of their captor, but as her work progressed, no such action appeared forthcoming. If anything, it confirmed that she and the captain were not being kept under close watch. Obviously, their captors did not believe they were capable of escaping from such an impregnable cell. After a length of time coaxing the panel loose and being careful not to harm herself further, the diamond-shaped cover popped off with a final creak of protest. It fell on the floor and skittered across the room. For a minute, Mary remained frozen, wondering if her success would bring any attention from their guards. Once again, no such action had arisen and she continued working. The neat diamond-shaped hole that was left in the wake of the panel's removal revealed a series of alien circuits and sophisticated isolinear chips. These were probably generations ahead in design to anything Starfleet had ever envisioned. For a long while she merely stared at the mechanism, trying to ascertain if there was a common frame of reference to the layout of circuits, relays and chips. She was no engineer, but she had basic engineering knowledge, a required course at the academy, not to mention what she had been studying since coming on board the Maverick. She studied the circuits carefully, fully aware that everything depended on her being able to make the mechanism work for her. They had to get out of here. Nothing could be done to affect their escape while they were trapped inside this tomb. A transporter mechanism must operate from this point because the panel came alive each time the captain was taken. Mary considered the possibility that their captors must have placed safeguards to prevent tampering such as this. She did not see any such devices. However, she was starting to hypothesize that her captors might be arrogant enough to believe that their technology was far too superior to be tampered by an inferior species. Then again, they were a highly specialized race, who did not appear to keep prisoners for any length of time. In either case, there was nothing to do but try. Once she began testing the individual components of the mechanism, time whirled by with frightening speed. Slowly, her keen intellect began grasping the concepts of the mechanism. Her eyes began seeing abstract comparisons with Federation transporters. In a rudimentary way, the process was the same. It was easy to visualize and hypothesize what each component might do. Mary found herself stymied by the problem of accessing its function, as its instructions were not meant to originate from this location. However, after giving much thought to it, an idea formed in her head. She was still wearing her comm badge. It had not been removed because their captors saw no reason to do so. The comm badge had only a finite range, and she did not doubt the Maverick was far behind them by now. It was certainly beyond the range of the comm badge to be useful as a communication device to signal for help. However, in itself it did contain various components that could be useful as an interface to the circuits and chips within the alien mechanism. The comm badge also contained a universal translator and, by definition, was capable of extrapolating all types of language forms into an understandable medium. It would not take much to alter its programming to enable it to communicate in a numerical form that was the most universal language of all. Once that was accomplished, the comm badge could, in essence, speak to the alien technology, and she could feed it instructions. It took another hour of lying out circuits and attaching the tiny wires to the inside of the transporter panel before Mary could make the attempt. She had wanted to wait for the captain's return, but knew logically that was ill-advised. If they were to return him to his cell, all they would need to do was activate the transporter panel and discover what she had done. The comm badge hung limply out of the opening. Only its wires connected it to the circuitry inside the opening. Tapping it gently, she hoped the interface would work and that both devices could speak to each other.
Initiate transport.
The comm badge should be translating those words into a numerical form and instructing the alien transporter to comply. There was no response.
Initiate transport.
Mary spoke again, trying not to let her failure overwhelm her with disappointment.
Now.
As if it could understand her inflections, suddenly, the beam appeared in the room. As before, it was difficult to see under the power of the strobe, but she saw the air before her shimmer with energy and knew that the beam was there. It approached her quickly and consumed her as readily as it had done the captain. Mary closed her eyes as she saw the world in front of her disappear and reappear a second later, changing shape and form significantly. The room was slightly larger than their cell, but not much more. Its walls were a metallic gray that was much kinder to her eyes after the contrasting white walls of their cells. The illumination inside the room was dim, and while she could see well enough, did not leave much for detail. Fortunately, there was no one inside with her, although she assumed there had to be guards posted outside the door at the corner of the room. Mary could not imagine any race being so incompetent. It would be unwise to leave the room that way, and she scanned the place for an alternate exit. At the base of one wall was a small metal grate, probably a ventilation shaft. It was not the most effective means of travel, but she decided it would be better than using the doors and risk being caught, if there were indeed sentries posted outside. Before that, however, she took a moment to conduct a quick reconnaissance. As of yet, neither she nor Chris had ever seen their captors, and wondered if there might be some clue to their identity in their machinery. She went to the console built into one of the walls. The controls were mostly touch-sensitive, requiring little dexterity, and as were all shaped like the panel in the cell. There was nothing resembling dials and buttons, switches or knobs. It seemed to her that the intruders were of a species who had difficulty using controls that required sophisticated finger dexterity. Perhaps their digit control was not developed. Mary studied the panel briefly before she made her way to the vent. Although she saw no evidence of surveillance devices in the room, that did not mean they were not present. The technology of this race was so unusual she might not know what she was looking at until it was too late. It was calculable that eventually they would discover her escape. She intended to use her time wisely until that point. Mary dared not risk being caught now she was finally free. Kneeling down, she pulled open the grate and set it aside as she examined the size of the shaft. It would be a tight fit for the captain, but she would have adequate space to breathe. Either way, she could not afford to be selective. Climbing inside, Mary barely managed to turn around as she replaced the grate behind her. Not daring to hope but admitting things were better than before, Mary let out a sigh and thought to herself, "So far, so good." An hour later, Mary had no idea where she was. The inside of the ship seemed like an endless catacomb of tunnels, accessways and shafts. While she had been crawling down these passageways, she began to notice something else of interest. Many of them were covered in thick dust that had accumulated over an unbroken period of time. It did not seem as if much maintenance was conducted. It also surprised her that no intruder alert had sounded over her escape as of yet. Finally, she decided she had to risk emerging from her hiding place to locate the captain. If he was returned to his cell, they would learn of her escape, and she disliked the consequences to him when that took place. However, finding him on this vast ship was no easy feat. She could only think of one way to find him, and that method was quite distasteful. It required her to drop all metal shields completely. She had to use his mind as a beacon to locate him. She was confident the bond between them was strong enough to achieve this end. Things would be so much simpler if he were a Vulcan whose telepathic skills were more than adequate for her task. Sion had opened her mind, and while she would never be strong enough to be considered even empathic, Mary knew she could find him. She folded her legs and took a deep breath, steadying herself for what was to come. Most Vulcans abhorred opening themselves like this, but Mary knew she was not Vulcan and there was no other way. As unusual as this was, it also happened to be the only possible way for her to locate the captain. She remembered the disciplines required to do this and tried to draw on the teachings of Vulcan elders to help her in her quest. Mary took several breaths as she felt the shields in her mind slowly descend like the curtains at the end of the play. Although she could feel emotions in her head from a host of minds, they were not as plentiful as she would have imagined for a ship this size. In fact, while their combined thoughts produced loud interference, Mary knew its volume should have been larger. Just how many beings were on board this ship? Adding to the mystery was the nature of their thought patterns. They were odd if somewhat simplistic. There was a certain orderliness to it that seemed undoubtedly alien. What struck her most was the level of unity they possessed with one another. Such cohesion among individuals was unheard of without some form of telepathic ability. Whatever the species was, they were single-minded in their goals and similarly dedicated. Finally, Mary forced their emotions away and allowed herself to concentrate on finding Chris. Her mind knew how to find him because of their emotional bond to each other. Although not as powerful as a Vulcan mind meld or upon far bonding ritual, it would suffice for her purposes. Her consciousness stretched across the expanse of the ship. Through the sea of feelings, she could sense his, like a lost grain of sand. Minute as it was, Mary could her consciousness extending forward like a physical force and reaching for it.
My mind to your mind. My thoughts to your thoughts.
There was the chance that he would not know what was taking place. To the untrained, the comprehension of telepathy was limited. There was every possibility he might consider her voice in his mind as some product of dementia and ignore it completely. Mary did not believe that of him, though. The captain had a strong mind and he knew their relationship could allow for this.
My mind to your mind. My thoughts to your thoughts.
She could feel his emotions entering her mind. Although he was not quite aware of her yet, she could feel the establishment of the link between their two consciousness.
Chris, can you hear me?
Once again, only silence echoed back at her. Perhaps, he was not conscious and could not answer. Nevertheless, the link was made and she rolled onto her hands and knees and began crawling up the shaft again. The invisible cord between them compelled her to keep moving, allowing her to navigate inside the maze of shafts to reach him quickly.
I am coming, Chris. I am coming.
This light has finally driven me crazy. Chris blinked and hoped that would help in some way to clearing his head. For an instant, he thought he heard Mary telling him she was on her way. For the last hour, they had left him on the table while they chose their next course of action. It appeared the Kakaia's foray into Federation space was to discover the secret weapon Jean-Luc Picard had used against the Borg. As it was, he was unable to coax more information out of them regarding the startling revelation they had made earlier. Could it be that this species had created the Borg? Chris could not imagine for what purpose the collective had been intended, but it was obvious that if the Kakaia were to be believed, their creation got loose on an unsuspecting galaxy. The Masters were now as vulnerable as the billions they had condemned to extinction because of the Borg. There was almost something poetic about it all.
Chris, can you hear me?
Chris shook his head and knew this time that sharp voice in his mind was no illusion or a figment of his imagination. He had heard it. It was Mary. Her voice was clear as one spoken out loud. Suddenly, his mind grasped it. Vulcan mind meld? No, that was impossible. Mary was human. However, Vulcans were telepaths and their mating ritual required some form of bonding process that was known to incite latent telepathy in some humans. He knew humans who were telepathic sensitive after such unions and knew it was possible to reach another mind if they were to lower their mental shields. While he could not confess to understanding all of it, Chris did hear her voice in his head.
Chris, I am coming.
Chris was very close now. She could measure the intensity of his emotions in a short radius from her position. Suddenly, she saw a grate further up the shaft and crawled quietly towards it. She could hear voices that seemed like a series of chirps and clicks. Had she been wearing her comm badge, the universal translator would have been able to make sense of this unusual language. Throughout her journey here, she had ascertained one thing: there were not many Kakaia on board this ship, which was somewhat puzzling considering its size. She reached the edge of the grate and waited for the voices to stop. The incomprehensible sounds of their language seemed fast-paced and heated, and Mary sensed something of great importance was being decided. She had a sudden premonition that her escape had been discovered. Peering through the slits in the grate covering, Mary saw through the dimly lit room that two figures had stumbled out, leaving one behind. She observed their movements were clumsy and awkward and their bulk was spindly. While they were definitely bipedal, there was something about their shape that required more investigation. A question for Dr. Jackson if she ever saw him again. She waited until the remaining alien exited another door in the room before she emerged from her hiding place. Without a doubt, she knew the alien had entered the room where Chris was being held. The situation was still risky, but if they had learned of her escape, then her time had run out and action was needed now. Carefully, she forced the grate open and climbed out of the vent. Despite the urgency of the moment, Mary was pleased to be standing upright again. Her legs ached from its cramped confinement. For a few seconds, she allowed her mobility to readjust itself. The room was no different from the one she had transported into earlier. Once again, the illumination was dim, as were the nature of the controls. She looked at the door where the other two aliens had exited and saw a panel not unlike the one in their cell. This one was most likely the mechanism controlling the door. She looked around and saw an odd-shaped tool sitting on one of the panels for which she could only guess its function. However, it was heavy and sufficient for her purposes. There was no way to do this with any kind of delicacy. With a controlled swing, Mary brought down the object against the panel with all the force she could muster. The cover shattered underneath the weight of the tool, sending shards in all directions harmlessly. It did make a loud crack, however, and Mary wondered if she had been heard. Never assuming anything, she jammed the length of the tool through the mouth of the broken opening. Letting go quickly, she saw tendrils of energy cackling across the tool from the internal mechanism. The short circuit she had been attempting to produce ejected sparks and smoke into the room. Mary hoped it would be enough to jam the door and give her enough time to retrieve the captain. She heard the other set of doors beginning to hiss and quickly ran to one of the walls flanking it. Mary remained still as the door slid open and a figure moved past her. Instead of remaining to confront the alien, she slipped through the opening and immediately slammed her fingers on the panel to close it. The alien whirled around as the doors started moving and Mary realized she had no idea how to lock it. She was going to have to attack. Mary dropped to the floor. She glanced over her shoulder as the doors hissed open again and saw the captain strapped to a table in the center of the room. He seemed all right for the moment, but she still had an alien to contend with before she was able to help him. The alien shuffled in awkwardly and Mary kicked out her foot, slamming into what could be its ankle, causing its legs to buckle beneath it. Once the alien was down, Mary saw the silhouette of what appeared to be its misshapen head and sent a flying kick into its face. It uttered a loud screech of pain as her foot connected before it went reeling against a wall. The alien landed hard, with a loud crunch as it hit the solid surface. Mary hoped she had not delivered a mortal blow because when the alien slumped to the floor, it did not move.
"Mary, is that you?"
Pushing all thoughts for the alien aside, she jogged towards the light. Chris was clearly pleased to see her when she stepped underneath the glare of the powerful light above him.
"I knocked out one of them.
My heart bleeds for him. Can you get me out of this thing?"
"Wouldn't be much of an escape if I can't, Captain,"
she remarked as she studied the device keeping him confined. Fortunately, freeing him did not look difficult. There appeared to be only one strategically placed button on the whole machine. Mary gathered this was the unlocking mechanism. Chris had informed her before his tortures on this table took place without the aliens having to enter the circle of light. Most likely, that function of the table was controlled by remote.
"Very funny, Lieutenant. I think I liked you better when you didn't have a sense of humor."
"Liar,"
she replied, pressing the button gingerly. The metal binds holding his body down suddenly released with a loud, audible snap. Chris did not waste any time getting to his feet once he was free. Although his muscles were stiff from hours of immobility, Chris was determined to put some distance between himself and this room. He gave his legs a quick massage to aid with circulation before he looked at her.
"Nice work, Mary."
She flashed him a radiant smile full of emotion and he saw the relief in her eyes at knowing he was all right.
"We have to keep moving. I'm sure they have discovered my escape."
Chris agreed with that assessment, but there was one thing he needed to do first.
"Do you think you can find the controls for this light? I want to see what they look like."
He had yet to explain to her the Kakaya may have been the race to create the Borg Collective, and if either of them escaped, the information to the Federation would be invaluable.
"I believe so."
Immediately her gaze shifted up and she followed the network of conduits that ran from the actual lamp. Within seconds, she found the controls and the room flooded with light. As Chris had suspected, the room was some sort of laboratory. There were instrument panels, console screens, and a vast variety of alien devices on each wall. One wall was host to an enormous refrigerated compartment. As Chris examined it, he saw dead specimens trapped inside clear canisters stored away neatly for easy access. They came in every shape and size, from small furry mammal-like creatures to races Chris could not even begin to categorize. All posed before him in a grotesque gallery of death. Chris wondered how many of these specimens had died naturally and how close had he come to becoming part of the display. As his eyes scanned the compartment, his stomach lurched as he realized the Kakaya already had a human specimen already. The man stared back at him with eyeless sockets. His ebony-colored skin had frozen to a pasty gray. Chris saw the Y incision in his torso and hoped the death he suffered was not as awful as it surely looked. This was probably an inhabitant from one of the destroyed colonies, Chris guessed. The callousness of the Kakaya enraged Chris and renewed his determination to stop their murderous experimentation once and for all. Suddenly, he heard Mary call out behind him.
"Chris, I think you should have a look at this."
Chris turned around and saw Mary standing over the alien she had attacked. He had been so busy examining the rest of the room he had forgotten his original desire to see what the Kakaya looked like. Judging from its length, the alien on the floor was humanoid-sized. However, at that point, any other resemblance came to an abrupt end. Its huge compound eyes stared at them, although both Chris and Mary were quite certain the alien was unconscious. It had no face to speak of, or at least one where features could be held distinct from the other. Its mandibles projected from the side of its head and were lined with a set of sharp serrations that could be called teeth. Tucked neatly between the thorax and segmented abdomen of its body were two sets of extra arms. None of these appendages had any developed fingers and had only two digits, if they could be called that. Its legs were clearly made for bipedal motion, although there were structural flaws that would make such movement awkward. Its skin appeared to be a kind of exoskeleton covered in thick spiky hair. Chris could not even tell what gender this particular alien was, but he could understand why they considered all other forms of humanoid life to be incapable of sentience. Chris had never seen any species closely resembling the Kakaia, and yet he knew immediately what they were. The Kakaia were insects. Chapter 21. Always Ducks. Both of them were still staring at the body of the unconscious Kakaia when they heard the distant thunder of someone beating down the doors in the next room.
"They've discovered I obstructed the main door.
We better make ourselves scarce."
Chris quickly surveyed the room for anything closely resembling a weapon. For once, their look held, and he sighted what looked like a plexiglass weapons locker containing rifles mounted against the far wall. Without wasting any time, Chris hurried to the case and tried opening its lid without much success. The panel beside the clear case was molded into the shape of a Kakaia hand, ensuring no one could commandeer the weapons within unless they were of the species.
"Grab him,"
Chris ordered Mary before they stepped towards the unconscious Kakaia. Although she was supposed to maintain a Vulcan stiff upper lip, he could see her revulsion as she reached for the Kakaia and began dragging it towards the panel. Chris quickly joined her and felt similar feelings as they hauled the Kakaia across the floor. Chris was hoping the movement did not awake their unconscious host, assuming Mary had not done severe damage when she attacked him. However, he remembered reading, as a good Vulcan wife she was schooled in their self-defense disciplines, and did not doubt this Kakaia would be out for some time. They reached the foot of the locker and Chris hauled the alien to its feet. Propping it up against the wall, Chris reached for the Kakaia's hand and slammed its palm against the molded imprint on the panel. The panel came alive almost immediately on contact, and after a short period of processing, Chris heard the soft click of the compartment's locking mechanism being deactivated. Wasting no time, he let the Kakaia drop to the floor as he reached for both weapons. He had no idea how any of it worked, but decided that was a question for another time. Preferably when they were absent from here. After distributing the weapons among themselves, Chris looked to Mary because she knew the layout of this place better than he did. After all, she had managed to find him in a ship this size.
"How did you get in here?"
"I'll show you."
She started towards the inner doors leading to the room from where the noise was coming from. Chris followed her without question because he was confident in her abilities. As it was, she had accomplished a minor miracle in escaping from their cell to find him. While they were far from being out of danger, at least they now had a chance of coming out of this alive. As the door slid open and they entered the room beyond the laboratory where he was being held, the pounding behind the door grew louder. The scent of smoldering metal had started to fill the room. He guessed immediately the Kakaia were trying to cut through the doors, as well as employing more physical methods of penetrating the room. Chris did not relish being around when that happened, or the consequences to Mary if they were caught. They needed him alive, but she had just proved herself to be a dangerous liability that could no longer be tolerated.
"This way,"
Mary declared, pointing to the open ventilation shaft.
"Get in."
He ushered her through the small opening. He wondered momentarily whether he himself would be able to fit in such a narrow passageway, but it hardly seemed appropriate to debate the matter at the moment. Once she had disappeared into the darkness, Chris climbed in after her. He was careful to replace the grate behind him, although it took a few seconds of maneuvering to give his shoulders enough room to move. He did not doubt the Kakaia would eventually guess how their prisoners had escaped the room. But the period between now and eventually could mean the difference between life and death.
"Ducks,"
Chris grumbled, looking at his surroundings before he was forced to move down the narrow space.
"It's always ducks."
"What?"
Mary looked over her shoulder in question.
"Nothing."
Chris shook his head and responded with a query of his own.
"Do you know where you are going?"
he asked as he followed Mary down the dark passageway. The sounds from the clanging doors becoming more distant the further they kept going.
"Not really. I thought we ought to put as much distance between us and where we were."
"Good thinking. We need to find their engineering deck."
Captain, that is going to be exceedingly difficult. I found you because of some mental ability, but it's not at all strong enough to do that.
You also said the same about getting out of our cell, but you're here.
Yes, but that was luck too. I'm not an engineer and you're overestimating my talents.
When they came to a juncture in the shafts, she turned around to face him.
I never underestimate your talents, Mary,
he said with a sly smile.
I'm looking forward to seeing all of them.
Mary rolled her eyes.
Grow up.
Killjoy,
he grumbled and then thought about what they ought to do.
We'll head towards the center of the ship.
You mean that sphere inside the ring?
She remembered thinking that the ship's strange construction might have something to do with its method of propulsion when they had first saw it from the bridge of the Maverick. She immediately saw where he was going with this. If they could damage it structurally, perhaps they could slow the ship down or at least take it out of transwarp.
I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be a central location for a key system. Even if it isn't the engineering deck, it might widen our options. They're called the Kakaya, by the way, and they think Jean-Luc Picard discovered some weakness in the Borg when he was assimilated 7 years ago. Right now, they're on a heading toward Borg space in the Delta Quadrant.
Mary was confused at their motives. Chris could not blame her. At Transwarp, the journey would take a little under a year.
But why take us? We're not important to them.
Chris paused before he answered.
You aren't, but I am. They want a starship captain they can sacrifice to the Borg for assimilation. They want to recreate whatever happened to Picard so they can have a conduit into the Borg collective consciousness.
Mary said nothing for a moment, but the fear he saw in her eyes was apparent.
All right. What do we do?
The circumstances, the Maverick is ordered to return immediately to Deep Space 5. It had come finally, and this time there was nothing Buck could do about it. There were no ambiguities to play upon, no more excuses or even parlor tricks. The communication from Admiral Wellington was specific with no room for misconception. It was a final decree he had no choice but to follow. After 24 hours of silent running, the Maverick had passed clearly beyond what was Federation space in its desperate search to keep track of Captain Larrabee and Mary. Although the transwarp signature gave them a trail to follow, it was obvious the intruder's superior velocity had taken them out of the Maverick's reach. After the 24 hours passed, Buck had little choice but to contact Starfleet Command and give them an update of their status. While waiting for their response, he continued the ship's course. Although Buck did not voice it, their current heading was taking them directly to the Delta Quadrant, or would do so if they continued on course for the next 80 years. With Wellington's words still ringing in his ears, Buck sat in the captain's ready room trying to find options in what was a seemingly hopeless situation. The moment the Admiral gave him that order, the situation was out of his hands. Obviously, Wellington did not think an untried first officer could handle a crisis of this magnitude. Buck could not blame him, of course. It was a reasonable assumption. Buck did not believe there was any malice tended behind the order. He was, after all, new to commanding a starship, and engaging an enemy like the one the Maverick had been facing required an experienced commander. If he knew what was good for him, he would withdraw from the pursuit and return to Federation space. However, he could not. There was something inside him that would not allow him to simply give up on Chris and Lieutenant Travis. He knew if he were in the same position, Chris would move heaven and earth to get him back. He knew as well as Admiral Wellington surely did, if they were to abandon pursuit now, in likelihood they would never retrieve their lost personnel. He still believed Chris would somehow escape on their own, but their survival after that depended on the Maverick being able to reach them when it happened. Yes, he was pinning his hopes on a very slim chance, and he knew it. The probabilities of such an event developing were almost non-existent. At this moment, he had no indication that either Chris or Mary were still alive or capable of making any kind of escape attempt. It was ill-conceived risking so many for a futile quest. However, the part of him that did not yield to reason, whose passion and fire allowed him to make far more accurate decisions with his heart rather than his head, told him that Chris Larrabee would never allow anyone to keep him caged for very long. If there was a way for him to escape, Chris would find it. After a few minutes of deep thought, Buck reached for his comm badge.
Commander Wilmington to Lieutenant Tanner.
Yes, sir.
Increase our speed to warp 9 and maintain pursuit.
Buck eased back into his chair, hoping to hell he knew what he was doing.
Acknowledge, Commander.
Vin's voice reflected his pleasure at the strengthening in their efforts to find the captain. Buck was aware Vin felt deeply for Chris and were cultivating a friendship growing stronger the longer they served together. There was no reason to let anyone else know about their orders, therefore he would limit the responsibility if it went wrong solely upon himself. As far as Buck was concerned, no one else needed to become involved in his insubordination. If there were to be any consequences from this action, Buck would suffer it alone.
Enter.
Buck sang out to whoever was behind the ready room door. When they opened, Alex Stiles walked into the room. His acting first officer was on the bridge when JD announced the incoming signal from Starfleet Command. She was no fool, Buck thought to himself. Alex would have guessed the reason for the transmission even if she was not present to hear it herself. Buck knew he had.
Can I help you, Alex?
She looked at him suspiciously as she stood before his desk.
Did Starfleet Command give us permission to maintain our pursuit of the intruder?
Buck paused, wondering how he ought to answer this question. He did not wish to lie to her because she was his first officer for the moment and undoubtedly any stain on him would not confine itself from her. However, he took a gamble on her response and decided to answer her honestly.
No, they didn't.
For a moment, she did not speak. There was no surprise on her face even though she understood the full implications of his order to Vin and absorbed it in quiet contemplation before she finally commented a few seconds later.
They ordered us back to Federation space?
I'm afraid so.
I gather you are ignoring that order.
His orders to Vin had made that a foregone conclusion and Alex could not say she disagreed with him.
For the moment.
Buck watched closely for her reaction.
I see. How long do you intend to maintain the pursuit?
It was a fair question. She had every right to know just how long he intended to keep violating orders.
I don't know.
I know what it is to be left behind, Buck.
Pain surfed briefly in her eyes and Buck wondered what the hell the Cardassians had done to her. Cardassians were known to be brutal in their torture methods and those who emerged from their prisons were scarred forever. While the records indicated she had been tortured, it did not say what exactly had happened to her. Those records were sealed and Alex did not feel inclined to reveal the specifics of her ordeal.
I'll support your decision in whatever you want to do. If you say that we maintain the pursuit, you have my full backing. I don't like leaving our people behind either.
Buck nodded slowly, grateful he had a partner in misery so to speak, in the course he had embarked upon.
Thank you, Commander.
I will get back to the bridge.
She returned his warmth with a faint smile before turning to leave.
Alex?
Alex looked over her shoulder.
Yes, sir?
You surprise me, Alex, but it's a good surprise.
She cocked a brow and answered.
I've been doing that a lot lately.
Alex thought about Vin and the expression on the Vulcan's face when she kissed him. She had a feeling Vin thought that had been a good surprise too.
Well, don't stop, I like it.
What was that sound?
Chris became aware of the faint hissing behind him. At first Chris Larrabee was uncertain of what he was hearing. However, he began to smell the faint odor of an unknown chemical in the air and knew something was happening. The small amount he had inhaled made his head swim and Chris realized the Kakai were trying to flush them out into the open. Obviously, their captors had guessed they were using the ship's vast ventilation system to evade capture and were taking measures to force them out of the tunnels. Chris looked over his shoulder and saw it seeping out of thin fissures in the walls. Within seconds, a cloud of smoke had formed and was coming towards them with unnerving speed.
We have got to get out of here. Chris shouted to Mary in front of him. They're flooding the shafts with some kind of gas.
Mary stopped long enough to look at him.
Coming out in the open could be equally risky.
She pointed out grimly but saw the greenish vapor coming towards them and knew their choices were limited.
I seriously doubt it's any riskier than remaining here, Lieutenant.
His hands were aching from this awkward position. His knees and his palms were screaming out in protest as they were forced to move faster along the narrow passageway. As it was, his bulk was his biggest obstacle for any speedy movement. He nevertheless scampered after her, grimacing each time his head knocked against the overhead ceiling and his shoulder bounced off the walls of the tight compartment. Mary was able to move with barely enough room to spare while he was forced to move, keeping his limbs close to his body in order to conserve space. He was so cramped he could barely think, let alone move with any kind of real coordination. The cloud was still coming at them, probably being forced up the shaft by the induction fans they encountered during their passage through these tunnels. Suddenly, he heard Mary cry out,
"Captain, I see a ventilation grate further up."
Following her exclamation, he noticed she had moved faster, although how she managed to in such confinement was beyond him. The fortune of feminine bone structure, he mused as he hastened his pace to match hers. After what seemed like an eternity of this undignified mobility, Chris saw Mary finally arriving at the air vent in question. She changed position with the agility of a trained acrobat and did not wait to see if it was safe beyond it. Chris cast a glimpse back to the green mist in close pursuit and was thankful she did not stand on ceremony when she slammed her foot against it. The force of her kick snapped its clasps apart and sent the metal covering flying forward like a projectile. She pulled herself out of the open shaft and dropped to the floor just in time to see two Kakai aliens emerging from the doors at one end of the corridor. Unfortunately, there was no way she could avoid being seen by them. Their reaction to sighting her was swift. They started running towards her immediately. Unlike the other Kakai she had seen earlier, these two were not hampered by cumbersome bipedal movements. Instead, their approach used not only their legs but also the extra limbs Chris and she had noted. Certainly, this was a more effective mode of travel because she was barely able to unsling her weapon and release one shot when they were almost upon her. One of the aliens was only meters away when it suddenly shot a thick blob of clear fluid from its proboscis in her direction. Mary jumped out of the way to avoid it, hearing its splatter on the floor behind her a second later. The initial blast from her weapon caught the other alien in mid-thorax and brought the creature down as it prepared to pounce. The remaining alien screeched in protest over its fallen comrade and spat again. Once again, she managed to avoid being hit, but her attempt to avoid it had placed her in a bad position to fire her weapon. The alien was inches from her and Mary was still fumbling with the weapon to get adequate hold to fire. Suddenly, a blast of energy streaked past her and struck the attacking alien dead center. It collapsed on the floor. Its thick exoskeleton made a loud crunch as it impacted. She turned and saw Chris on the floor. He had fallen out of the grate and remained where he was to take aim when he saw the alien about to attack Mary.
"Are you all right?"
He picked himself up from the floor. They could not remain here for too long. Already, Chris could see tendrils of the gas inside the shaft starting to seep out of the grate into the corridor. Mary nodded in response to his question, unable to deny she was a little shaken by the moment. Combat was not something protocol officers had to deal with, especially one who had been stationed at Vulcan for most of her career. She rose to her feet and was on her way towards him when she noticed the floor where the fluid ejected by the Kakaya had landed. It made her stop immediately and lean down for a closer look. The two areas where the fluid had landed were smoldering. The fluid was eating through the metal plates of the floor. "What is it?" Chris joined her.
"It looks like some kind of molecular acid."
"That would be consistent with an arthropod life form. Most insects break down food products by regurgitating digestive acid. They eat the food after it has liquefied,"
he explained as they retreated from the growing cloud. Fortunately, the corridor was long enough for them to leave it far behind. Now they were on foot instead of their hands and knees.
"I suppose a higher order of insects might decide to use that method as a form of defense."
"Gross but effective."
Mary wondered what would have happened if the substance had made contact with her skin. The corridor was almost 50 meters from one end to the other, Chris noticed as they advanced toward the opposite end. The low hum prevalent throughout most of the ship had become an actual vibration he could feel in the air. Out of curiosity, he placed his hands against the cool steel of the wall and felt his palm tingle at the microscopic shutter.
"Can you feel that?"
Chris asked. Mary had been listening to it. In fact, she had noticed it as soon as their melee with the Kakaya had passed minutes ago. However, it was no mystery to her what it was. She recalled what the ship looked like prior to their kidnapping and believed she had a good idea where they were.
"I believe we are on one of the pylons connecting the outer ring of the ship to the inner sphere."
"At least we made it this far."
He sighted a door at the end of the corridor and stepped up the pace towards it. "I'm surprised we don't have the entire ship combing the halls for us."
"There does not appear many Kakai on board, Captain,"
Mary informed as she fell in step with him.
"How so?"
"When I dropped my mental shields in order to find you, I was able to get a sense of the minds on board this ship. The volume of personnel does not seem consistent with a ship this size."
Somehow, that did not seem as outlandish as it sounded. Since their escape, they had made it halfway across the ship without being detected. Although the Kakaya had flooded the shafts at every point, two guards per grade seemed to be a small compliment regarding the importance of their prisoners. Even now, The corridors were similarly deserted. While he knew he should not complain because this improved their chances at escape, it did make him wonder why.
There are many questions about the Kakaia. First of all, I believe them when they claim to have created the Borg.
You think they're responsible for the collective?
Mary asked as they closed in on the doorway. Chris had studied classes in advanced xenobiology when he was at the academy and was surprised how much of that knowledge remained intact, even after so many years.
If true, then it would explain some aspect of Borg behavior. For instance, the hierarchical structure of the Borg. Like most insect cultures, the queen is the leader and all others are referred to as drones. We've seen the Borg refer to themselves in the same way. Their collective consciousness may have been forced to induce the same kind of single-minded unity shared by insect colonies.
If you are creating a warrior race, it would make sense that you fashion it after yourself.
She agreed as they reached the door.
Although their purposes escapes me. Obviously, the Kakaia are advanced enough to wage wide-scale warfare without creating such an aggressive warrior caste to do their bidding.
That's true. However, we don't know all that much about them. Until we do, we can only guess what their motives are.
They reached the door and both Chris and Mary took a defensive position flanking it. With their weapons drawn, Chris nodded at Mary when he activated the door panel. The door slid open. Neither of them moved for a few seconds as they waited to see if any Kakaia would come through to investigate. After a minute or so, Chris deemed it was safe to enter the room and peered over the edge of the doorway.
Oh my god!
Chris whispered softly. Mary saw his eyes widen in disbelief. The weapon he had been holding was primed to fire, dropped aimlessly to his side as he stepped out into the doorway and walked into the room. For a second, she could not fathom what could astonish him so completely until she herself looked inside. They had both been wrong about the sphere being the center of the ship's propulsion system. When Mary followed Chris's gaze, she saw a room so large that it took up the full area of the sphere as viewed from space. However, what astonished both Starfleet officers was not its size. While they had been wrong about its purpose, they were certainly not wrong about it being a key area. The room was a cargo hold and in it was the most precious cargo of any race. It filled every inch too of space inside the large area except for one small aisle that cut through the center of it.
Captain,
she responded in a soft voice.
Are those what I think they are?
Yes,
Chris nodded grimly.
They're eggs.
Chapter 22. Hatchery. Eggs. Hundreds of them. No, Chris quickly amended. Not hundreds but thousands. He knew what they were on site. That much about his entomological studies remained intact. The rows were endless and they stretched from one end of the cargo hold to the other. All were placed in orderly rows, each with a mechanical attachment which Chris gathered controlled its environmental requirements to prevent hatching. He could not say how he knew that the technology was meant to prevent birth, but it seemed to make sense somehow. The eggs were no more than a foot high, tubular in shape, and did not seem too dissimilar from the egg sacs of Earth insects, except these were a great deal larger. As he and Mary stepped off the platform and descended to the floor of the hatchery, Chris could see the vague shapes inside the translucent wall of the eggs. Infant Kakaia moved languidly in gelatinous fluids, completely unaware of the world beyond them.
There must be thousands of them,
he heard Mary declare. She was staring at them with a mixture of horror and fascination. Chris shook his head at her expression. Women and bugs. 500 years of equality and they still got the jeebies whenever they spotted something with more than four legs.
At least,
Chris responded as another thought occurred to him that had nothing to do with this aspect of feminine behavior. Hurrying back onto the platform, Chris activated the door panel and waited for it to slide to a close before raising his weapon. Taking a careful aim, he fired one shot into the center of the panel. The energy blast impacted against the device, sending sparks in all directions. He stepped back to avoid being burned by the stray embers and was content to see the panel completely destroyed. Jagged rips of metal glared at him while burned circuitry hissed and cackled through the torn fissure.
"That ought to buy us some privacy,"
he said, returning to the aisle where Mary was currently moving her gaze over the cargo hold with an expression he knew all too well. It was evident she was gathering information about this part of the ship. Her eyes moved across the beams and the walls of the hatchery with deep concentration. He wondered what captured her attention so completely.
There appears to be a stasis field protecting these eggs.
The revelation did not surprise Chris, however. He had gathered as much even though he had no solid evidence to back the assumption. Following her gaze, he realized she had come to this conclusion because there was a slight shimmer of energy encasing individual egg being generated from the mechanical receptacles they were mounted on. Combined, it almost looked like a veil of stardust hung suspended over each one egg.
I wonder how long they've been like this.
God knows. I can tell you, however, this does explain why there are so few Gekkai on board.
Does it? Chris looked at her skeptically. I fail to see how.
They are obviously the guardians for these hatchlings.
If that's true, why risk the cargo by coming into direct conflict with the Maverick?
Chris countered.
We're not exactly a threat to them.
I don't know about that. We may not have been in the beginning. While their technology is formidable, they're not invulnerable. We've seen that we can hurt them.
I can't see why they would take a ship into battle with cargo like this.
I don't know. However, if even one of our quantum torpedoes penetrated the hull of this cargo hold, the entire hatchery would have been lost despite its shielding.
Shielding?
She looked at him. Chris came up alongside of her and pointed upwards.
Do you see those conduits running across the ceiling and the walls?
Mary did see them. However, the conduits were so fine it could have been any number of things. They ran across the length of the ceiling and across the hold that remained exposed to space. Sometimes they even crisscrossed over one another but were never more than 1 meter apart. Until one actually looked, it was easy to miss these conduits as they were designed to blend into the background.
I see them, but couldn't that be just normal circuitry?
I don't think so. I think it is a shielding of some sort as well as an anti-transporter mechanism.
Mary was not even going to question how he came to that conclusion but was confident he was right. Starship captains seldom made such speculations unless they were absolutely certain of what they were talking about.
That's a good thing for us. At least they won't be able to beam us out of here.
True.
She remarked and continued her observations. So many questions, Chris thought. He was starting to form a vague idea about all this in his head, but there were still too many gaps to be sure if he was right. As they continued walking through the aisle, Chris felt uneasy about being in here with all these eggs. The Gekkai had shown themselves to be ruthless aggressors. He didn't want to be here when the adult Gekkai found them. Whatever he thought of the species was irrelevant. The beings inside these were children, not responsible for the crimes of their elders. If a firefight erupted in here, the eggs could be damaged or worse yet, destroyed.
Let's get out of here,
Chris suggested and hastened his steps as they made their way down the aisle.
I don't like this place.
While Mary could not share his discomfort, she did understand it and thus hurried to keep up with him. They had not taken more than a few strides when the silence of the room was suddenly shattered by the sound of someone pounding against the steel door. Both of them reacted to the noise and knew that their privacy was going to be short-lived.
Damn, I was hoping for a little more time before they found us.
That was always going to be a slim hope, Captain.
I won't argue with you there.
They ran down the narrow aisle through the sea of Gekkai eggs. When they reached the end of the aisle, the passageway banked sharply and led to a set of doors they had not seen from the distance. It did not appear to lead out of the sphere, however, but seemed to be a smaller room in the hatchery.
Through there,
he ordered Mary, deciding they had little choice to be selective at the moment. Chris reached the door panel first and slammed his palm against the activation pad. Fortunately, these panels did not require any identification or else they would be in real trouble. The door slid open without protest and Chris entered first to ensure it was safe to do so. The measure soon proved valid as a Gekkai leapt in front of him and spat a shot of fluid.
Duck!
He shouted at Mary as he jumped out of the way to avoid being hit. Turning around swiftly, he delivered a flying kick in the alien's torso and then brought down the butt of his weapon against the Kakaya's head when it doubled over. Mary had thrown herself against the opposite wall when the alien's venom, for the want of a better word, struck the closing doors behind her. Immediately, the corrosive liquid began eating into the steel. While she did not think it was quite strong enough to eat all the way through, it certainly reaffirmed her belief at its potency if it came into contact with flesh. She saw the captain attacking the alien and raised her own weapon in reaction.
Don't move.
She warned with ice in her voice while keeping aim at the Gekkaia. Not that it was in any position to protest as the captain's blow had left it quite dazed as it staggered against the panel for support.
Thank you,
Chris said appreciatively, as he collected himself and unslung his weapon. Once the captain was ready to take over, Mary looked around the room. While he was attempting to question the Gekkaia with little success, Mary focused her engineering expertise to the purpose of this annex. It was a control room of some sort. She decided immediately. There were console screens showing a wide range of environmental readings, everything from atmospheric temperature inside the hold and the integrity of the stasis field protecting the eggs. Except for the wall where the door was located, the rest of the walls were taken up machinery. There was also an image of the cargo hold on one of the consoles. It was most likely this Kakaya that alerted the others to their presence. However, it was incidental compared to what caught her attention.
Chris,
she said in more excitement than she meant to show once the discovery had been made.
Does this mean what I think?
Chris hurried to her side and saw what she was looking at.
Yes, it does,
he said with a smile.
The sphere is capable of separating from the rest of the ship. It has independent propulsion systems and what appears to be a communication dish. I think this is the main control room for the hatchery.
That would make sense. If the ship was in trouble, they would be able to get the eggs away to safety.
For a moment, Chris felt silent as he considered the new possibilities ahead. The idea forming in his head was distasteful, but unfortunately, he had little options left. Once again, he wrestled with the moral implications of what he was doing and knew that the debate was over. The moment the Kakaya had destroyed Federation colonies, they had thrown down a gauntlet of challenge Chris Larrabee was forced to take up.
We're going to have to polarize the stasis field.
Mary looked up, certain she had heard him correctly.
I beg your pardon, I thought.
You heard right, we're polarizing the field.
Captain, doing that might kill the life inside the eggs.
I know, but we're going to do it.
Had she misjudged him? Was he really capable of doing this, even for the sake of their lives? For a moment, Mary did not know what to say and then realized he must have a reason for this request. By God, she hoped he had one.
Why?
Are you murderers? Those are infants. They have not harmed you.
With Chris's universal translator still functioning, both Mary and he were able to understand the Kakaya and so would it, when he responded to its declaration.
You did not seem to have this crisis of conscience when you obliterated our colonies. There were children on those worlds as well, or do they not count because they are not Kakaya?
I do not know anything of that. My responsibility is to the hatchlings only. I am of the Karer caste. I have no influence with those of the High caste.
Well, that's too bad. We're doing it, Lieutenant.
His tone clearly indicated he wanted no arguments on the matter as he gave her quick instructions on the how. Mary knew better than to argue and she turned to the controls in order to begin. She had no more than reached the panel when she heard the Kakaya respond with more urgency.
You cannot do this. Stop.
Chris raised his gaze and met the alien's compound eyes directly.
Then help us escape.
His voice full of icy deliberation. That made the Kakaya stop in its tracks. For a moment, it did not know what to do. Chris could almost see the conflict that was raging within it. Did its responsibility to the caste supersede its responsibility to the eggs under its charge? Chris sympathized with the decision it had to make, but he had to force the Kakaya to choose. Their lives depended on it. In the meantime, there were immediate problems that required attention. With his eyes fixed firmly on the Kakaya, Chris spoke to his engineer.
Mary, see if you can find the audio control to the outside corridor.
After a moment or so, he heard her answer.
Here it is.
She nodded and gingerly approached the communications panel in the complex. As she began working on his request, Chris addressed the Kakaya again. Time had run out for it to consider its options. A decision had to be made now.
Kara, I need to know if you are going to help us. I do not wish to destroy the hatchery, but rest assured I will if I think that is the only way to escape your ship alive.
Chris paused a moment and then added.
Kara, if you help us escape, I will see to it no danger will come to the hatchery. My companion and I only wish to return home.
You will not harm the unborn?
I give you my word, for all it is worth to you, that if you help us escape, the hatchery will remain undamaged. However, I cannot guarantee its survival if we do it alone. Our knowledge of your technology is tenuous as it is, one wrong button pushed and we may accidentally destroy the entire hatchery. Do you wish to take that risk, Kara?
Captain, I have activated the communication relay in the pylon. You may speak to them now.
Do I have your answer?
Chris demanded, not tolerating any further hesitation.
Will you help us?
Finally, the Kakaya nodded slowly.
I will help you, if you keep your vow, that the unborn shall not be harmed.
Good. Now, how do I get a visual of the corridor?
He asked quickly. The Kakaya stepped forward gingerly, conscious of the weapon pointed at him as he walked towards the console. His odd-shaped digits moved across the controls with surprising dexterity, and within seconds, one of the inactivated screens came alive with the image Chris sought. There were at least 5 Kakaya at the door, trying to cut their way inside. Chris knew they could not be allowed to penetrate the hatchery, so he had to make his move now. Taking a deep breath, he spoke.
To the Kakaya attempting to penetrate the hatchery of the unborn, stop immediately.
Chris saw them react to the sound of his voice. They stopped working on the door and searched the source of the voice. It did not take them long to realize that it had been transmitted from elsewhere. One of them approached the image recorder mounted on the ceiling of the pylon and glared directly into it. While all the other Kakaya Chris had seen so far were a dark, bluish color, this Kakaya and his companions were hued in crimson shades. If a caste system was in effect here, it was likely these were the warrior drones.
"We will do no such thing, human,"
the leader responded indignantly once the initial shock faded away.
"You would be wise to give yourselves up immediately."
"I don't think so. Your power over us ended the moment we entered your hatchery. You cannot recapture us without endangering your own. We have seized command of your hatchery control, and if you and your fellow Kakaya do not withdraw to the outer ring immediately, I will jettison the entire contents of this sphere."
"You would not dare such an atrocity. We will destroy you and your entire race for such murder."
"Then you will withdraw,"
Chris said coolly, unaffected by the Kakaya's vehemence.
"Never."
"Mary, depressurize the sphere."
"You promised not to harm the unborn."
"Your eggs are in a stasis field, are they not?"
He turned to the Kakaya.
"Yes, they are protected inside the field."
"Then depressurizing the sphere will not harm them, even if it is for a short period of time. I do not intend to carry out my threat unless provoked, Kara. I am merely expressing to your comrades the threat I make is real."
That seemed to calm the Kakaya down a bit, but Chris did not intend to trust him with too much. The alien was too agitated and too unfamiliar with the situation to be reliable. As Mary activated the depressurization process, a red warning light began flashing inside the room, indicating the commencement of the procedure. Klaxons began screaming inside the hatchery and outside it, Chris was sure. The warrior Kakaya certainly heard the alarm for depressurization, because within seconds, he heard their leader shouting at him to stop.
"You savages!"
He heard them shout and wondered if they could be any more hypocritical, considering what they did to the colonies on Calendra 2, Omega 6, and God knows how many others.
"There is still time to stop this,"
Chris addressed them again.
"Withdraw now and we will abort the procedure."
The Kakaya turned to the others in his group to make the decision, with the sounds of klaxons wailing the background, reminding them the consequences of the wrong choice. After a moment, the leader turned back to Chris and responded in a low growl.
"We will withdraw for now."
"You made the right decision,"
Chris answered, not allowing it to show either in his voice or in his face how relieved he was they had not forced him to go through with his threat.
"Now, leave the pylon."
"What guarantee do we have that you will not harm the unborn when we have complied?"
"None. However, you can be assured the hatchery will remain safe for the time being. Now leave immediately, or you might give me the impression you intend to go back on your word. Trust me, that would not be wise."
The threat in his voice was clear, and the Kakaya did not dare gamble with the lives of their precious cargo. At least, not until the odds were better stacked against them. Chris knew his advantage was temporary. The Kakaya had formidable technology on their side and may be preparing to use it even as they stood here contemplating their next move. Finally, the stalemate was broken and the Kakaya warrior contingent made a reluctant retreat. Once they were gone, Chris turned to Mary and the Kakaya carer.
"All right, we don't have much time. You're going to help us separate the ship."
"That has not been done in centuries. I am not even certain if the ship is structurally capable of doing so now. You are endangering all of us by this foolhardy attempt at escape."
Chris wondered how much of its protests were genuine and how much of it was an effort to stall for time. In either case, Chris was not going to pay the Kakaya's outburst more attention than necessary.
"I am willing to take that risk. Now you will help us, or I swear I will go out there and shoot every one of the unborn before your eyes if necessary."
He raised his weapon higher for effect.
"Do we understand each other?"
The venom in his voice surprised Mary, and she wondered how much of it was a facade for the benefit of the Kakaya. She knew humans could be extremely violent when they wanted to be, and this side of the captain unsettled her greatly.
"I understand."
The Kakaya nodded, suitably intimidated for the moment.
"I will assist you as I promised. I will reiterate, this ship has not separated for a great length of time, and I cannot assure you it will work."
"Show my engineer what needs to be done and it will."
Chris answered with a little more calm in his voice. The Kakaya turned to Mary and said quietly,
"It will take a few minutes. The pre-launch sequence must be followed exactly. I have never done this before, but I am told that there are no shortcuts to the procedure."
Mary nodded as the Kakaya set to work.
"What time we have will have to suffice."
As Chris heard that, he sighed to himself and hoped it would be enough. They had only one shot at this, and failure was not an option.